What Can One Do? By Yaron Brook. Objectivist Summer Conference, 2016.
Thank you. And guys ready to go home? No. Oh, that's what I want to hear. Good. Well, we've decided to extend the conference, right, Anu? We're going to do another couple of days. So what can one do? Well, the first question one has to ask when you hear something like that is, about what? Right? Now, we've heard a lot at this conference on what you can do to improve your life. We just heard a fantastic panel about what you can do to apply the objectivist values to your business life, to your career. We heard Tara Smith earlier about what you can do to make your life a happy life. So just to create the context here, what I'm talking about today is what one can do about the horrible state of the world in which we live. And I'm not going to spend 15 minutes describing that. Too depressing for you and too depressing for me. We live in a world where I think we all understand that the real problems out there, the real challenges, they want to take our freedom away. They want to take our property away. They want to take our lives. Not a joke. That's what's happening out there. We have a real enemy in the culture, in the political world, at the universities, across our entire culture. So what I want to talk about today is what you can do to fight back. And this is about fighting back. But there's still another question we have to ask ourselves. Before we decide, before I tell you what I think you should do to fight back, and that's a question of, should you do anything? Why fight? Right? Why fight? And I hear this a lot when I go around meeting people. You know, why fight? Why get involved in this? You know. Now, start with why should you care about the future? And I think we've heard a lot in the conference about why you should care about the future. You heard it from Tara Smith. Because it's your future. It's your life. It's your values. You should care about the future because it's yours. It's part of what your life is. When we talk about rational self-interest, when we talk about living the best life that you can live for yourself, we're talking about over the span of your life. You need to be able to plan for that span of your life. And you know, for some of you, that's another 50 years, maybe 100 years if there wasn't an FDA. Not funny. Sad, because I'm serious. And for some of us, maybe it's less than that. Maybe it's 10 years, maybe it's 20 years, maybe it's 30 years, but that's a future, and it's our lives, and they're coming after us. And to think that what we should do when people are coming after us and want to destroy our lives is, I'll just sit back, let stuff happen, is absurd for anybody who values their own life, for anybody who's really selfish. Now, I meet a lot of people who have different views about fighting for the future, and you can categorize them as kind of, there's a certain determinism that some people have. And the two types of determinism that I see out there are optimistic determinism and a pessimistic determinism. So I meet a lot of people, particularly in Silicon Valley, this is true, but it's also true outside of Silicon Valley, and it's particularly true of people in the technology world. Stop this, Yaron. What are you talking about? First of all, life is good. And I'll get to life is good in a minute, because it is pretty good. We're gonna change it through technology. Technology is that life always gets better. If you look at the last 100 years, every decade, standard of living's gone up, quality of life's gone up, wealth is gone. Yeah, they're cutting away at our freedoms, but look at the internet, right? You can be anonymous on the internet today. You can do financial transactions that I know they're listening right now, but the IRS can't track if you really wanted to. there are things you could do, and the future is even bigger, right? Blockchain and Bitcoin and all this stuff. And we're gonna, and they're gonna not gonna be able to shut down the service, and they're not gonna be able to monitor us because we're gonna encrypt everything. So yeah, the NSA can try, but look at what just happened with this iPhone. Now they did break into it in the end, but that's because it's not the latest iPhone. If it was the 6S, it's not clear they would have been able to break into it. So we can protect ourselves. Most of our values will be out there in cyberspace. And I always say, but they'll shut down the servers. And they say, what servers? They're not going to be servers. You know, every light bulb's going to have a chip in it, and it's going to be distributed, and it's going to be, and that's just going to happen, and we're just going to be free. So don't worry about it. Forget about the fight. Now, once in a while, they'll actually admit that we live in a physical world, and we own homes, and we actually have to eat, and we drive to work and stuff. So there is a real risk, because in the physical world, there are guns, and the guns can be pointed at us. Once in a while, they'll admit that maybe there are real threats, and certainly I believe that, yeah, I believe in technological progress. Again, I'll talk about it in a minute. But that can be shut down. We know it can. And it can be used against us. That same technology that potentially can liberate us can be easily turned against us. The world is not deterministic. The world is determined by the free will of the people in it. The world does not have to get better. If you study history, you know this. The world can get worse. It can get a lot worse. Now, granted, you have to study really history a long, long time ago, right? The fall of Rome or something like that. Of course, unless you live in Venezuela, which was not that long ago, the richest country in Latin America, and today is by far the poorest country in Latin America, where there's no freedom, nothing. All the technology in the world has not helped the poor people of Venezuela, who are being devastated right now. So that's one form of kind of deterministic optimism. Determinism, it's optimism. Everything's going to be fine. Don't worry about it. The second form is the opposite, right? It sucks out there. It's really bad. There's nothing you can do. This is just the cycle of history. We're all going to hell. What's the point in fighting? I get this all the time. Or we've lost. Why even try? What's the point? Again, that's not an answer. It's your life. They're coming after you. What do you mean I'm just going to sit here and accept it? Life is not determined. History is not determined. The future is not determined. The future is what we make of it. So if you accept free will, if you accept volition, if you accept that we can change our own lives and therefore we can change the world, we can change other people's lives, as Ayn Rand said, one mind at a time, then you can't be a fatalist, a determinist of optimism or pessimism. But then there are the people who accept the free will argument. But you know, it's just too late. I mean, look at all the bad stuff. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. I mean, I don't need to say any more than that. It's just horrific. It's never been this bad in America. And it's getting worse. What are we going to do? How can we do it? Can't think about it. I'm just going to, you know, ignore it, not do anything, sit back and let it all happen. And you see that. There are lots of people like that out there. They don't want to deal with it. It's too hard, too scary, and they're just pessimistic. Life just looks ugly. Everywhere they look, they see the bad. Now, I'm not like that, and I don't want you to be like that. I think we should be able to see a positive path, and I think we can see a positive path. And to do that, I think you just have to open your eyes and look around the world, because Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are not what even this world is about. In a sense, they are the aberration. We're sitting here in a city, town, beautiful place, right? And you're enjoying walking around, seeing the scenery, amazing buildings. Everywhere you look, there are homes, many of them massive, right? Huge homes on the lake, up in the hills, beautiful place. One guy built this entire place. One guy. This is Bill Gates' country. This is Bill Gates' country. One entrepreneur made this happen. And it's phenomenal. And you got to smile, right? This is amazing. We live in a world in which one guy with a vision, with an idea, with ambition, with hard work, has created the world in which we live, the city in which we live. Wow. We live in a world with heroes. Bill Gates is a hero. I don't care what his politics are. Look what he built. Look what he did. He is a hero. I mean, it's sad that he doesn't know he's a hero. But we at least should know he's a hero. And we should celebrate that. We should embrace that. That's fantastic. You know, we live in a world, you know, I love to use my iPhone, right? Every talk. It's become my thing, right? We all walking around with supercomputers in our pockets. How can you be pessimistic with a supercomputer in your pocket? Whoever believed this was possible just a few years ago? Right? It wasn't possible just a few years ago. It's still somebody, in this case Steve Jobs and Apple, and made it possible. I just read a story about the Zika virus. They now have a vaccine that works on mice. 6 months it took them. It used to take 10 years. But there's now new technology to create viruses just like that. They now have gene splicing technology that can, I don't know what they can do. I'll pretend, right? They can do genetic engineering at a fraction of the cost and at an accelerated speed. Amazing things are happening in our world. Granted, in certain sectors and not in others, but amazing things are happening in our world. And as long as those amazing things that happen in the world, we cannot give up on mankind. We cannot give up on the human mind. We cannot give up on individuals, on freedom, on everything that makes those wonderful things happen. It's those things that should inspire you to fight, because that's just a fraction of what is possible if the world was really free. Right. So, you know, optimism is this weird word, right? Because what does it mean to be optimistic? What does it mean to be pessimistic? We're realists. We go by the facts, right? We are objectivists. But what are the facts about the future? How do you know? What probability do you have on X happening or Y happening? Now, we know ideas drive the future, but do we know the speed in which our ideas will get out there? Do we know which minds we'll get when? How do we even know that? How do we estimate that? To some extent, we're guessing about the future. Well, if you're going to guess about the future, why not guess more positively? Particularly given that we can see what people are capable of. What we are capable of. So I'm a realist. I know the role of ideas. I know how hard it is to get ideas out there. But I'm also an optimist, because I see what human beings are capable of doing. I know we can change minds. And I know that we have reason and reality on our side. So should you want to do something, what can one do? Yeah, you should want to do something. Because we can change the world, and we should change the world, and we are going to change the world together. We need all the resources we can in order to do it. So let's talk about what we can do indeed to change the world. So again, the first thing we have to recognize is what kind of a war we're engaged in, right? What kind of battle of ideas are we engaged in? Well, first, it's about ideas, right? I gave it away there. This is a war of ideas. This is about philosophy. This is about the fundamental beliefs that people hold. This is not a political battle. This is why at the end, who cares who wins this election? It's not going to matter that much one way or the other. It might matter for a concrete here or concrete there, but in the scope of the next 20 years, it's not going to matter. It's much more important whether we can get our ideas out there into the culture, whether we can convert minds out there, particularly of young people out there into the culture, in the culture. Much more important than who particularly wins this election. The end of the day, is there that much difference between Republicans and Democrats? And don't give me, you know, I know people are going to argue with me about this, but there isn't. It's not about politics. And even if it was about politics, we lost that one, right? We'll talk about politics in 20 years. We're not going to influence this election. Everybody says, Yaron, you have to endorse a candidate. I said, what difference does it make? Nobody listens to me. And, you know, maybe some people listen to me, but it's such a small group that I'm not going to change the election. You're not going to change the election. We need to think long term. We need to think about philosophy. We need to think about ideas. What changes history? If you read Ayn Rand's Theory of History, if you read Leonard Peikoff, what changes history is philosophy, our ideas. If we're going to win, if we're going to fight, the fight is on the battlefield of ideas. The fight is a philosophical fight. Okay. So what does one do? Well, first, if you're going to go into a fight, what do you need to have? Great weapons. Great weapons, right? The other side has nukes, so we better do better than that, right? Now, what are the weapons that we have? We have Ayn Rand's ideas. We have incredible weapons. We have the best weapons in the world. We have the best philosophy in the world. It's an amazing weapon. And what are we trying to convince people? To be happy. To take care of their own soul, their own life, their own being. That should be easy, right? And we have the tools. We can answer philosophical questions. But to be able to do that, to be able to do that well, to be able to win, to be able to bait people, to be able to argue, to be able to convince, you need to know how to use those weapons. In other words, you need to know the philosophy. Before you go out there on social media claiming that you know how to change people's minds and you know what's best for their life and you know what's best for the political system and you know which regulations, why regulations are evil, you better know what you're talking about. So step one in what you can do to help change the world is study objectivism. Learn it. And you know, you have no excuses because it's all there, right? All the books are available. All Ayn Rand's works are available. Many of them online for free. All these fantastic courses are available. Leonard Peikoff's magnificent courses, all are available for free. And they need to be studied. You can't just listen to them while you drive. Sorry. It doesn't work that way. This is philosophy. You wouldn't think of studying any other topic by driving around, right? You go to school to study. You write notes down. You take exams. You do it properly. Well, there are courses there. They're available to you about a life-changing philosophy that you already have accepted. You need to get to become great soldiers, to become great lieutenants, to become great generals. You better know what you're talking about. But to really know what you're talking about, you need to know the philosophy. You need to have it integrated. You need to have it in your mind as a whole. You need the system. And again, it's right there available for you. You know, when I read Atlas Shrugged a long, long time ago, I finished the book, and then what? And you know the cards inside? There were these Box 177 cards. You remember those? I thought nobody's going to answer me, so I never even sent it. Talk about a fatalistic attitude. And then I'd scrounge around looking for books. And this was in Israel in 1977, no internet, nothing really in Hebrew. Little books, used bookstores we used to go. And for 3 years, I thought I was the only person in the world who knew anything about these ideas or cared. And she was still alive. And I didn't know that. And there were lecture series, and there were booklets, and there were pamphlets, and there were newsletters. I didn't know any of that. So I kind of have an excuse, but you don't. Right. You have it all there. On an electronic platter, right? Available to you. Take advantage of it. You don't know objectivism. You can be an objectivist, in my view, but you don't know objectivism just by reading Atlas Shrugged, unless you really read it a few times and you really study the Galt speech. But to know objectivism, it's to study it. So study it. Again, if you want to fight for your values, if you really think your life is under threat, I do. And I need you guys, because I need troops and generals and lieutenants. You're not all, what's the lowest rank? I forget. Cannon fodder. You're not all cannon fodder. I like that. Thank you. And this is where I think Greg Salimieri's talk was so important earlier this week. You've got to be objective about what you know. What you know and what you don't know. Figure out what you don't know. And fill in the gaps. Now, you don't have to know the philosophy as well as Ankargate to be a soldier. Maybe that's why, he's a general. I don't know the philosophy as well as Ankar does. Okay. You don't need to know the philosophy as well as Leonard Peikoff does, so certainly as well as Ayn Rand does. But to the extent you want to engage, to that extent, you need to know the realm in which you are engaging. If you want to specialize in a certain topic, then know that topic and know how it integrates into the other areas in philosophy. Have a good sense of what it is that you know. And then, in debate with other people, be willing to acknowledge that you don't know. Be willing to acknowledge that you're not sure. It's really important. Because if you start BSing them, pretending that you know stuff, they will notice it, they won't take you seriously, and they won't take the philosophy seriously. So be objective about what you know and convey that sense of objectivity. Okay, so study the ideas. Know what you know. Learn, learn, learn. Lifetime learning, we heard earlier today? Absolutely. And in objectivism, it really is lifetime learning. This philosophy, objectivism, Ayn Rand's ideas, is one thing, and then all its applications, and how to apply it, and where to apply it, and the best methodology to apply it. This is endless. I'm learning all the time. Learning all the time. And it's fun to learn, right? So this isn't a duty. It's not a burden. This is something you should be enjoying. All right, so what should one do? Learn, learn, learn. Study the ideas. Second, live. Live. And I mean live, like Tara, live, She did it much better than I do earlier. Live the best life that you can live. Make the most of what you have. Be a successful businessman like Carl Barney and John Allison. Be a model in whatever it is that you do. Be a model so that people look at you and say, what's their secret? Oh, Ayn Rand something, objectivism something. That is the most powerful tool you will ever have, is your own success, your own happiness. So I'm not saying live in order to show off other people. Live because you should live. But by the way, that is a great tool in this fight. Maybe the most important tool. And if you have the ability, and if you have achieved a kind of level of success that we saw in this previous panel. Then the scale that you get. Think of how many people John has talked to, or think of all of Carl's students and employees and the people he's touched, or Rajshri, all the students she has, and her colleagues who admire her and kind of go, wait a minute, how could she be an objectivist and she's good? But it's being good that's important. You need to be good to be an effective soldier out there in this war. You have to be good. You have to live up to the, and I mean live up to the philosophy you are advocating for, to the philosophy you believe in. And the world is hard out there, and in some professions it's becoming harder and harder. But I see too many people in objectivism, using objectivism as an excuse for their failure. Watch for this. Don't let yourself get caught up in this. We still live in a world in which success is possible. We still live in a world in which we can thrive and we still can flourish. So don't let objectivism become an excuse. Objectivism is a tool to be successful. If you can be successful here and that's your primary, your number one value and goal, then go to number two. I mean, that's the world we live in. We're realists, right? We have to be real in terms of what's possible. If the government has blocked you off in one path, then go to the second path. But there are no excuses not to live. You only have one shot. Make the most of it. So live the best life that you can live. That is, that will have more impact on the people around you. Help us in this fight more than anything else that you do. Be successful. So we got learn, we got live. Then you got to speak. You got to speak up. You got to take a stand. You got to say, I disagree. You got to be able to present the ideas and present an alternative. And be positive, present a positive alternative to what's going on in the world. Speak, speak, speak. This is an intellectual war. And as an intellectual war, it is ideas that matter. So express those ideas. If they're just in here, it doesn't help. So find all the different ways in which you can express yourself, from little things, like just saying to a bunch of colleagues who are talking about, I don't know, the world is going to come to an end because of man-made global warming. I disagree. And be ready to defend that, right? You can't just say, I disagree and walk away. But that doesn't mean you have to give everybody a speech. That doesn't mean you have to give you have to go with everybody to metaphysics. It means you have to defend that idea to the extent that they're interested in listening. If they don't want to listen, that's okay. But you said what you had to say. You planted a seed of doubt in their mind. They know there's an alternative. They know there's something else out there. You know, read Ayn Rand's small essay, What One Can Do, which this talk is named after. She has a lot to say about speaking up. Think about the way you're presenting the ideas. Think about the way you're coming across. If you're going to be obnoxious and a jerk, which some objectivists have been known to be, I'm not going to mention names, don't worry. Nobody's going to take you seriously. Nobody wants to talk to a jerk, even if you happen to be a truth teller. You have to know how to convey ideas. They have to perceive that there's a trade here, and the trade is not just the words. It's how you say them. It's how you conduct yourself. It's what kind of person you are. Are you somebody they want to engage with? And look, everybody else in the world is wrong. We know that. You don't have to pound it on them. Because that's not going to help again. I see so much of this on Facebook and Twitter and social media. Where, you know, somebody says, you know, there's a conversation going on. Somebody says something that's wrong. And everybody just says, oh, well, if you think that, then you must be a SOB or whatever, and walks away. Well, but the whole point of the conversation is you knew they were wrong. and you want to deal with it. You're trying to argue against it. You're trying to make a presentation opposite. Now, I'm not saying everybody's worth discussing stuff with, because some people very quickly you realize they're not worth talking to. But if you're going to talk to them, you know, in the Jews say, be a mensch. You know, be nice, be friendly, be positive. That's the kind of behavior. Now, again, not to everybody. Some people deserve, what did Alex Epstein say, the FOF, right? Some people deserve that. But the purpose of engaging with somebody is not to tell them to go OF,
right?
Or FO, or whatever, right? So speak, talk, write letters to editor. Just a quick warning about writing. Writing is a profession. Writing is hard. You need to learn how to write. And the longer the piece, the more difficult, the more complex, the more knowledge you have in order to do it. Books are not trivial. Books are substantial. So either become a professional, or in my view, leave it to the professionals. That doesn't mean you can't write an op-ed, a letter to the editor, shorter pieces. There are lots of things that can be done. There are lots of writing that can be done. Get the word out there. Get ideas out there. And again, you don't have to present everything, even a little bit, even something that challenges people. And if you can slip in there, you know, go read Ayn Rand, that's great. One of the things, so that's speaking, and together with speaking, I would add kind of activism. A few years ago, Ankan and I did a series of talks on cultural change, and I still highly recommend those talks for anybody who's really interested in being out there on the battle with us, in the field of battle with us, because I think there's a lot you can do to help in terms of change. And if you look at other movements, they knew their stuff, they learned. They don't quite live, because living doesn't count for them, right? The environmentalists are anti-living, so they can't actually model the behavior. I wish they would, actually, the non-living. But they're very good at speaking, and they're very good at activism. Get out there and be engaged. And this is where, I don't know, some people interpreted me earlier about not getting involved in politics. Get involved in politics if you find that interesting. Go to the city council and pound on the table. Run for the city council. You know, just don't expect an objectivist to be elected president next week, because it ain't happening. But there are lots of other political venues in which you can get engaged, where you will have a forum to discuss ideas, where you present ideas. But make sure what you're presenting are intellectual ideas, a real philosophy. You're not quibbling about little things that don't matter. Get involved. I mean, the right, the religious right, has done a great job at taking control of textbooks. Imagine if there were groups of objectivists going out there and getting involved in textbook selection in the state of Texas, which kind of determines textbooks for the rest of the country because it's so big. Right? It's things like that, but there are a million different things in which you can be active. Many of you, or some of you, got involved at the Tea Party originally. That had to be done. Now, I don't know that it turned out very well, because the Tea Party's kind of imploded and we're still too small and we didn't have enough of an influence. But hey, we took a risk and it was worth a shot. And you know what? We're going to fail sometimes. We're going to try things and they're not going to work. So what? Right? Businesses fail. Nobody gets too excited. Entrepreneurs can be serial entrepreneurs. They fail. They learn from the failure and they go do something else. As long as you learn from your failure, go do stuff. If you fail, try it again. Try to do something else, or try to do the same thing better. So get involved, get engaged, go be activists in whatever realm interests you, in your professional realm, in a local community realm, in a local political realm, in whatever it is. Let's start hearing an objectivist voice out there. Okay. So we got to learn, we got to live, we got to speak. And then we got to support. Now, this is an intellectual war, which means it's going to be waged primarily, not exclusively, primarily by intellectuals. You saw many of those intellectuals up on the stage during this conference. You can become an intellectual. Please become intellectuals. We need more intellectuals. If you want to pursue an intellectual career, we at the Ayn Rand Institute are here to help you. We want, need, desperately need, this war needs thousands of objectivist intellectuals, not dozens as we have today. But we have intellectuals. They need support. And support comes in many forms. Financial support, write a check to the Ayn Rand Institute, to send a check to help out Alex Epstein or whatever. Right? There are lots of intellectuals out there who need your help. We are on the front lines fighting this every single day. Even if we're in our offices, what we're doing is writing and speaking and doing the stuff that we believe needs to be done to fight the fight for ourselves, but also for you. So when we ask at the Ayn Rand Institute for money, we're not asking for sacrifice. We're not asking for you to do something that goes against your values. Quite the contrary, we're asking for a trade. It's a division of labor. We are specialists at this. This is what we do for a living. We're pretty good at it. We can convert and influence more minds. We have leverage. We thought about this. You're paying us to do that work for you. And that's how I hope you think about it. But this is a philosophical battle, an intellectual battle. It's philosophers and intellectuals who are going to win this. That's where their fight is. Culture is changed. History is changed by minorities. Minorities of intellectuals. Not by majorities, by minorities. By thinkers. By advocates. By teachers. By writers. But it's not just financial support. Moral support is incredibly important. Remember, we're out there on the front lines fighting. It's not easy. We get bloodied once in a while. We appreciate any kind of support you guys provide for us. Just a thank you sometimes goes a long, long way. A long way. And this group is pretty good about that, both in terms of writing checks and in terms of thank yous. So that's great. Thank you for supporting all of us. Other things that you should think about when you're out there fighting. There is a lot of good content produced by good intellectuals. There are a lot of good essays. There are a lot of good op-eds. There are videos, there are lectures, there are courses, there are books. These are the tools, these are the weapons that you take out there into the battlefield. Use them. Use them. So I see so many objectivists trying to come up with an original way in which to articulate an idea that Ayn Rand has already done, that, you know, we've probably done in 5, 6, 7 different ways at the Institute. Quote us. Link to stuff. I mean, this is the beauty of technology today, right? You can link, you can quote, you can use social media. Get the word out there. We've got the tools today. And I've said this in many, many other lectures, right? At a marginal cost of zero, we can get information, knowledge, philosophy, ideas out to billions and billions of people. And the more people do it, the more people post on Facebook stuff that is important. That cat video is cute, but this is important. The more people will see it, the more people are attracted, the more people will read, the more people will study, the more we win. Use the tools that we have today. Let's use this amazing technology that we have today. Truly amazing technology that we have today. Let's use it. But the thing about the technology today is it's kind of distributive, right? It's like a network effect. If I post something, then X number of people see it. But if everyone in this room shared one of my posts, the number of people who see it is exponential. It's unbelievable the number of people you can get to with just a click of a button. Now, I know once you click that button, you're committed. All your friends see what you've just clicked. But we're soldiers on a battlefield fighting a war for our survival. A click is not that big of a cost. Use social media, use technology, use the internet, use the fact that all this content exists, Think about Ayn Rand's articles on Ayn Rand campus. You know, you just heard from Carl how important the objectivist ethics is. Yeah, I agree completely. Greatest essay ever written. It's amazing, right? There it is. It's on AI. Everybody in the world can go and access it. Everybody in the world can. Zero cost to them. All you have to do is share it on Facebook. Share it on Twitter. Put it on Instagram. I don't know. Snapchat, does that work that way? I don't know. I have no idea. You guys know. See, you guys do it. But they think of the networking effect. Think of what's the potential of reach. Billions of people. So use the fact that there's tons and tons and tons of intellectual knowledge out there. You're supporting the intellectuals, you're supporting your cause, you're speaking, and you're getting it out there. So I try to come up with a clever acronym for the four steps of what you can do, but it came out LLSS. It's just the way it's going to be, right? Learn, right? What was the second one? Live, speak, support. Learn, live, speak, support. That's what you can do. Now, you don't have a duty to do this. It's not something the AI police is going to come and inspect. But it's your life. It's your life. It's your future. Some of us has kids. And our future, when you have kids, your future suddenly gets extended. Because, yeah, when you die, it's all gone. But while you're alive, it's not. While you're alive, you're thinking about your kids' future. And part of your happiness, part of what makes you feel good, is knowing that they will have a future. If I knew my kids didn't have a future, it would be hard. I think for anybody here who has kids, that would be devastating. That would be devastating now. Not after you're dead. After you're dead, you're dead. So posterity is about now. When Ayn Rand said fighting for the future is living it today, she meant it. It really is living it today. And living for it today. And fighting for it today. Look, 240 years ago, a group of men came together to run an experiment called the United States of America. They created something that had never been seen on the planet. A government organized to protect individual rights. Nobody thought that would ever happen. Nobody knew it could happen. Nobody had the concepts to make it possible for it to happen. And here they made it. They did it. They fought for it. They created it. For 240 years, that vision of what is possible to man has been under attack. Daily. First, it was small, wasn't significant, although the fact of slavery was a big drag on that vision. But it's been intensifying. For the last 100 years, it's been an intense attack on that vision. And today, it's hard to find the remnants of that vision still out there. These bastards want to take our lives. They want to take your liberty. They are already taking your property. And they want to make it impossible for you to pursue your happiness. God damn it, we got to fight them. Not a little bit, not sometimes, not somewhere, but everywhere, all the time, constantly, not as a duty, but because this is what your life necessitates. Now, I'm in this fight. I hope you are too. Thank you. All right, Q&A. You're cutting into my Q&A. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Uh, Yaron, thank you for an inspiring speech. My question has to do with what I sometimes perceive as a possible conflict between my activism, which is based mostly on my personal interests, versus trying to identify what are the really important issues. To give a personal example, my Facebook page is likely to have many posts about religious totalitarianism.
Yep.
Not just one religion, and also dangers to freedom of speech.
Yep.
I'm not likely to have something about eliminating government schools,
sure,
as important as I think it is.
Sure.
Is there a case to be made for becoming a generalist rather than sticking with your personal preferences?
No. No. So let me say this. So everybody heard the question? Your interests are going to make you more passionate, more knowledgeable, more able to make the case than if you were talking about something you weren't that interested in. You're going to study your interests. You're going to invest in your interests. And then you're going to be a better advocate for those. And look, philosophy is an integrated whole. You can go anywhere, right? Right? You can make an attack anywhere, and you can link the religious authoritarianism to morality and their attack on egoism, to epistemology and their attack on reason, and you can present the whole philosophy on any issue. So no, I'm all for specialization. I think it enhances your ability, it enhances your confidence, it enhances your knowledge, and it's not narrowing. Don't think of it as narrowing. Now, I will say this, though, and I'm not talking about you, because I wanted to make this more broader point. There are people who get obsessed by a particular topic, and then they start presenting it as if it's the only topic that matters, and they start presenting it as if we don't win on this topic, the world is lost, right? I see this, there's a whole group of people. And some of them have justification, right? There's a whole group of people who think, we're going to be taken over by Islam. Islam is going to kill us all. And that's the only issue that matters. We should just be writing on Islam. And let me tell you something. Islam ain't going to win. We might lose, but they ain't going to win. The number one threat to America is not that, right? But you need to talk about it, right? But don't become hysterical about that one thing, because the attack against us, multifaceted, they're coming at us from all directions. It's not one element, it's many elements. So weigh it right, right? And again, some people, that's their thing. I mean, Bosch, that's his thing. He draws Muhammad and he grew up in that culture. So that's his issue, and I understand that. But don't overdo the one issue that you do and realize that it's in a broader philosophical context, intellectual context, the fundamental ideas that are driving all this. And at the end, the enemy is not the other. That's Donald Trump's line, right? The enemy is always the other. The enemy is us. It's our ideas. It's our philosophy. It's our professors, our being American or whatever you are. That's where the battle is, right?
Yes, what do you think about the importance of shared values, meaning a subject that actually a particular person or audience wants to hear? I have done a couple of presentations, and when I have not taken into account who the audience is and what specifically they might be interested in, it hasn't gone as well as I would have liked.
Yeah, as a public speaker or as a teacher, you learn that probably the most important thing is the context of the audience. What do they care about? What are they interested in? Who are they? Right. So this talk was to objectivists, right? If I'd given this talk to, a random group of students, they would have looked at me like I was nuts, right? So you got to take into account what interests, what is the focus, what is it about this audience that you can hook to, that you can connect to? Shared values are crucial. Is there some topic that they really, and you're talking about, they care about, they care about technology, and you're talking to them about Muslim invasion of Europe. I mean, it's, right? Yeah. I mean, you can get to that, but try to get to it through the thing that they're really interested in, right? Through what's fascinating to them. And again, because of philosophy, because what you at the end want to get to in many talks, right, is ethics or epistemology. You can do that. Yeah, you can take any topic up here and bring it down, right? Everything you can bring to the abstraction, down or up, however you want to look at it. But to some philosophical abstraction, it is important. Now, you also have to know that you can talk about the particular topic that the audience is interested in. I mean, there are groups I can't talk to because I don't know anything about. I don't have any shared values with them. Yeah. Right?
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you, Yaron. And thank you, everyone, for being so welcoming to us first-timers. It's very encouraging just to be here. Do you think that talking to relatives is a good place for someone to start? I've had some marginal success with my sister, for example. She really seems to get the idea when I tell her that altruism, for example, is a philosophy that's impossible for someone to practice.
Yeah. Yeah, I think family is a good place to start, as long as it's you have good relationship with the family that you don't mind ruining him. Family is going to be generally, for the most part, more tolerant of your being obnoxious. And you'll say, but again, this is practice, right? We're still practicing. So when you practice, you don't know exactly what you're doing. So I can say, I practiced on my family for many, many years, and I feel sorry for my family. Right? Because I was an obnoxious objectivist. I thought I knew it. I read Atlas Shrugged, and this probably happened to most of you. You read Atlas Shrugged at 18, and here you are with the most powerful philosophy ever, with the truth. And you're 18, and you know nothing about life, and you don't have many experiences. But you've got this abstract philosophy that you know is true, and it is. And it's like you've been given this massive weapon when you don't know even how to shoot a little pistol, right? And you have to be careful. And to me, family gets the first brunt of that attack, right? And you practice on them. And hopefully you learn what works and what doesn't work. And you need to learn not to be obnoxious. In the meantime, you're growing up a little bit. And you're learning a few things. And, but relationships are going to be ruined, right? I don't think my family looks at me exactly the same after that as it did before. But, no, it's a safe space. And you want a safe space to practice. But don't expect to succeed. I mean, that's generally, you're only going to get one mind out of so many. And it's not necessarily going to be your family. At least in my case, it wasn't.
Thanks.
After a decades-long career of looking at a computer, I finally found a way to get paid to talk to people. So I can speak. Number 3 on your list?
Yeah, I remember that one.
Now, I'm not speaking about philosophy so much. I'm teaching English. But
yep.
If there's anybody out here who wants a job, part-time job, teaching English as a second language, there's 300 million Chinese who are dying to learn English. There's plenty of students. Just see me. Maybe I can get you a job.
Thank you, Yaron, for your presentation. And I would like also to thank all the donors which made it possible, for example, for me and other students to come from Poland and I can bring objectivism back home. Thank you. My question is, with spreading our ideas, how far do you think we should or could go with compromises? Because objectivism is kind of strict ideology, strict philosophy, and we are realists, as you said, so it's maybe easier sometimes to work in Republican Party or defend capitalism on altruism argument. What do you think about it?
So I think you should never compromise on philosophical ideas. You can work within the Republican Party, but always stand for what you stand for. Never say, well, okay, this week I'll agree with a little bit of altruism and everything. No, you got to stick to it. This is why we can't win in politics short term, right? Because we can't get elected. As charismatic as whatever, we'd lose in a landslide. But you got to stick to the ideas. Otherwise, what are we doing? You're not going to move the map. Somebody has to define, the ideal. There are going to be plenty of other people compromising. conservatives and libertarians and others, and if we plant the flag, or liberals on the left, we plant the flag on the principle. Let them come to us. We don't need to go to them. And if we don't do that, in a compromise, Ayn Rand wrote about this, in a compromise between good and evil, where good compromises, evil will always win, will always win. So they will always win. And this is what's happened. The better people in politics have always compromised and lost. And long-term. They might have won a little battle and lost long-term. Yeah, but let me mention, you translated that video, right?
A friend of mine.
A friend of his. So a friend of his in Poland took a video of mine. This is the kind of thing one person can do and the impact you can have. Right? Took a video of a talk I gave in Maastricht, right? And it was an hour and a half, an hour 40-minute video. And he took out a question that really he thought was interesting, and it's a 7-minute clip, and it's bad quality and everything, and he put Polish subtitles on it, right? And he put it up on YouTube. And within like 4 or 5 days, 20,000 people watched this thing, most of them Poles. And, you know, today it's well over 50,000, and it's just a 7-minute thing, but I bet you a number of those people said, wow, I was particularly good in those 7 minutes. If I can say so myself. If you've seen it, it's called Yaron versus Student. Very simple. And a lot of them then went on to listen to other lectures. And my guess is a lot of them went on to read Ayn Rand, because Ayn Rand now is becoming more and more popular in Poland. And I think it's because little acts like that do it. I'm just going to go for a little bit. I'll take a question in a minute. An example of what one person can do in Bulgaria. Right? Bulgaria is a relatively poor country and a relatively oppressed country. It's a very corrupt government, very corrupt government. And yet, if you look at Google and you look at how many people per capita search Ayn Rand, number one is the United States of America and number two is Bulgaria. Bulgaria. How come that? Well, it turns out that 10 years ago, Kalin, who's here in the audience, discovered objectivism, discovered Ayn Rand, and there he is, he's right there, discovered objectivism, he discovered Ayn Rand, he arranged for all the novels and most of the nonfiction to be translated, all the novels, most of the nonfiction is translated into Bulgarian. He's worked to market it. He's got a TV show where he advocates for these ideas. He brings in speakers. He does stuff. And Bulgaria is number two in the world on searches on Ayn Rand. That is amazing. One guy. Thank you, Colin. So what can one do? There you go. There's great examples. Yeah.
Yaron, that was a very inspiring speech. In fact, it's remotivated me in some respects. I recommend that it become a permanent feature on the Institute's website that you can click on and doesn't disappear in 30 days. I think it's very valuable inspiration for anybody that goes there.
Thanks. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yes, my university colleagues very often come across Ayn Rand's ethics first. They examine Ayn Rand's ethics from the viewpoint of Kantian epistemology and, of course, reject it. When they finally come across ITOE, they say, okay, she's a first-rate philosopher. This is the most useful book on epistemology, especially people in my field, information systems. They use it. They love it. But it's almost impossible to change an opinion that had once been formed. Do we have a strategy for reaching academics by starting with epistemology rather than ethics?
I don't think we have. We have a number of strategies with regard to academics. And for example, there have been a number of seminars on epistemology that I know the late Alan Gotthelf organized, and Greg Solimieri, and some other objectivist philosophers have organized, where they brought some of the best most open epistemologists to various conferences, small group conferences, where they've discussed Ayn Rand's epistemology. So there certainly have been attempts there. I don't know that we've had any attempt like information science on getting introduction to objectivist epistemology. But let me say that, and as you said, even though they get their epistemology in information science, they're not willing to change their ethics, even after they got their epistemology. And to me, this is more why we really focus on young people. Before they have these things really established in their minds, before they are committed to a particular way of life and particular ideas. When you're young, you're still looking, you're still searching, you're still open. You know, you're still available to discover new things, and you're willing to discover new things. So I am big on going after young people, 15 to 30. It doesn't really matter where you want to put the cutoff. But exposing them at least at that young age, they know there's an alternative. They might not explore it when they're young. They might only go back to it later on in life. But they'll know at some level that there's an alternative. I think once you get to be a middle-aged academic, it's very hard to change your views about things. And if I had to invest dollars, I would much rather invest them in young people than in academics. Now, granted, if you pick and choose your academics, if you find the ones that are more open to these ideas, like we've done with some free market economists, where we brought them all together and we've talked about objectivism, and we know we already have something in common, and now we can go deeper and help them go deeper. And even there, the success rate is good, but it's not great, right? So the older the people are, the more difficult it is to change them. And the more expensive the investment becomes. So I would focus on young people to the extent that we can. Yep.
So my question kind of goes, contrasts that. I think it's really, it's a lot easier to encourage the youngest people to get involved since they have maybe 60, 80 years left to invest in. My question is, do you have any specific advice for the oldest generation here?
Look, if I was on the verge of falling dead tomorrow, I wouldn't be here. I don't know exactly where I'd be. I'd have to figure that out, but I wouldn't be right here. So, look, you have to put it in the context of your own life. But if, as I said, if we're planning in 10 years, 20 years, if that's our scope of planning, and I think everybody here is planning for at least 10 years, right? There's enough time to do stuff. There's enough time to live. There's enough time to fight. And fighting is living. It's part of life. Given the world that we've inherited, given the world in which we live, fighting is part of life. There just isn't any options. I used to think it was optional. I don't think it's optional. I don't think you just sit back as civilization is crumbling around you. I don't think you just pretend it's not happening. I don't think you just do your thing. If you're really selfish, if you really care about your life, then you gotta fight. So I think everybody should be engaged here, young, middle, old. I don't know what old means anymore. As I get older, it's. But yeah, so I don't really, from that perspective. Once you're committed, once you have these ideas, get engaged.
Thanks.
And I think it can be fun. This can be stimulating. You learn stuff. You engage with people. So this is not, again, duty and sacrifice or anything like that. Yeah.
Yaron, I'd like to state that this whole conference, the entire week, has been for me like art concretizes values, I think, all of you, not just you, but all of you, all of the speakers, concretized activism and what one can do and how one can win this fight. So
good.
Thank you first for that. I also regret that I'm from India. I've come here after thinking about coming for 20 years. And I really regret that I didn't come earlier.
Yeah, so no regrets, guys. Sign up for 07. You're getting a 55% discount for
absolutely.
17, not 07.
And my question really, or maybe a request would be that, you know, you've talked about how sometimes one gets disheartened by the state of the culture. That's the basis of your talk today. And it's so in the U.S., where, for instance, perhaps as I think Ayn Rand also said, is one of the countries, if it doesn't survive, then the rest of the world goes with it. But out there, in the rest of the world, it's even more disheartening.
Yes.
And of course, there are bright spots, and it's great, you know, what's being done in Bulgaria. In fact, I was with Kalin over lunch trying to understand how we could do something similar. But is there a word that you'd like to put out to many adherents of objectivism out there in the world, on the margins, in the boondogs? And what can... Do they matter in the larger fight? What message do you have for them?
Yeah, I mean... Look, this has become a global movement. It's become a global movement, I think, for two reasons. One, because we ventured out there, I and some others ventured out there into the world and discovered they're really good people out there and they're doing cool things and we want to be engaged with them. And so we ventured even further and further and kind of made it a global movement. But second, and I think this is an indispensable second, technology. It doesn't matter where you live, you can fight for these ideas. You can fight for America. You can get on a Facebook feed and you're fighting for everywhere, right? So this is a global movement. And technology has made the globe small. Not just because we can fly anywhere very cheaply, very relatively fast. Actually, speeds of airplanes have been declining. One of the signs of the decline of civilization is how fast our airplanes go. But we've got an objectivist working on a supersonic jet, right? So how cool would that be? It's a global movement, and technology makes the world small and makes it easy to become active, and it makes it easy to get information all across the globe. We at the Institute have become much more aware of the fact that it's global and are facilitating that by going overseas and traveling, and it really is everywhere. I mean, I don't have a list here of all the countries I've been to just in the last, 24 months, but there are a lot of countries, a lot, right? It's probably 20 countries at least in Asia, South America, and Europe, right? The only place we haven't really done anything is Africa. Well, Antarctica, but the penguins don't really care about objectivism. So, don't be disheartened. I'd say there are two things you can do. One, come to America. In spite of what Donald Trump says, we're going to make you welcome. We want you here. Second, if you can't come to America or you don't want to come to America, there are lots of reasons why you don't want to come or you can't. There's lots of fight out there. There's lots of things you can do. There's a huge difference you can make, both in your local sphere and in the global sphere. Again, technology allows you to access everywhere.
Okay. So for the sake of simplification, I want to explain.
You need to speak a little bit.
For the sake of simplification, I want to explain the work I do, but let's just say I do nonfiction work and fiction work, and I want to know in the context of this, everything you said, which one do you think is more important in your opinion?
If the fiction is really, really good...
Well, I should have explained.
No, that's fine. I mean, I mean, it's a general point. I'm not making this personal, right? Mm-hmm. Art is incredibly important. We will not win without great art. Now, and remember, what made most of us objectivists, certainly what made me objectivist, is fiction, not nonfiction. I became an objectivist from Atlas Shrugged. Without Atlas Shrugged, I don't think... I mean, I'm not like some of you who read Virtue of Selfishness, something like that, and turned into... That would have meant nothing to me if I'd read it. Atlas Shrugged is what did it. And we need more, right? And we need it in every realm of aesthetics. Aesthetics is vital. And one of the things that I'm saddened by, in the objectivist movement, is that... I don't get a sense that we value aesthetics enough. I'm passionate about art. If you ever visited my home, you know, I mean, I'm plastered with sculptures and paintings and music library, and I watch tons of movies, and I love this stuff because I love art, and I think we all should. I think it's a vital part of life, and I think to the extent that we can create great art, that is so rare and such spiritual fuel. And I'm glad that at this OCON we had a whole arts thing and, lectures, but we also had an exhibition. And these are the kind of things we need to do more of. We need to be more engaged in aesthetic experience. So you have to do what you think, not what you think will change the world, but what you think you will enjoy most, will add most value to your life, and if it's really, really good, it'll have the impact.
Okay.
Thank you again for this talk, Yaron. This is exactly what I needed.
Good.
I was wondering if you'd seen a productive way parents could work with their child's school to introduce these ideas?
Well, I don't know that you can introduce the ideas into the school unless you have somebody at the school committed to the ideas. But what I would say is, as a parent, you've got to speak up. You got to tell the teachers, stop teaching my kid garbage, right? And I remember, you know, a long time ago, my kids were at a Montessori school, and they used to get this little, do you remember what it was called? This Scholastic magazine, this little magazine, Scholastic. It goes to all over the country, and they used to distribute it at the school. And there was an issue of this Scholastic magazine that really pissed me off. I mean, it had like the premier of China coming to visit America, and everything's hunky-dory. Oh, this is wonderful. Not mentioning anything about, you know, the political state in China. But what really got me is all the penguins that were dying because of global warming. Just presented as fact, right? This was in Scholastic magazine. So I went to the teacher and I said, this is ridiculous. You want to present global warming? Present the other side. You want to say something about the Chinese thing coming in? And she was like all defensive and, you know, because they don't have a leg to stand on. They don't know their arguments. So if you come in confident, then they'll back off. They stopped distributing Scholastic magazine at that school. Because instead of giving an alternative position, they just stopped doing it, right? So go and talk. You know, this is when I say speak, speak, speak. Schools are the most important places to do it. It's your kid. So it's not just enough at home to counter the argument. It would be much more powerful if the teacher stopped making the argument. So I think that's the best way to do it, other than finding an objectivist, and they are, luckily, but, you know, schools out there, short of that, or short of becoming a teacher and doing it yourself, just going and speaking to the teacher and setting in a very reasonable, nice way, look, I'm really offended by this stuff. I think this, I don't agree with it. I think it's wrong. I don't think kids that are 4 or 5 years old, or 6 or 7 or 10 or whatever, should be exposed to it. Please stop. Andrew.
I want to make a plug for one more piece of social media you can use, and I learned this one from the Crawfords. Quora.
Quora, that's right.
Quora, it's a great site. You can go on it, and you can write at a length that you really can't do for as broad an audience on Facebook. You get editorial-sized work you can do, and it's a great way to make a point and quote Ayn Rand, and you can be short and succinct, but it gets the name out there.
Yeah, I don't know if you know what Quora is, but Quora is where people just post questions. They just post questions, and then anybody can write an answer. And I think people who write many answers or answers are rated higher, get more cred on the thing. And I know Jack posts, and Jason also does, right?
Yeah, I'm one of the top answers for different objectives of topics on Quora. So
Ayn Rand's like a Tagwood. And then, so Jason is one of the top posters on that particular topic. So his answers bubble up to the top, right? So that people get exposed to that first. And then there are probably some other good answers, some really bad answers. But Jason's is probably high up. You can do that. And again, it doesn't have to be on Ayn Rand. It just can be on something you are specializing in. But you can bring in Ayn Rand. Because again, philosophy is everywhere. Use that fact. It means that you can make philosophical principles if you do it smart. Don't just, you know, pound people, but if you do it smart, you can bring in philosophical concepts almost anyway. Yep.
Hey. In the age of sound bites, you know, it's very difficult to get people engaged to, you know, commit to a long term, you know, whatever, write a book or whatever. What I still find important is, for instance, on one of your latest radio shows, you said, Buy my new book. Buy it today. Get us on the bestseller list. You know, as you said, there's one click away. It doesn't cost you a thing. And for instance, are there more like short term things that? For instance, I think it's important that everybody gets on Amazon and leaves a review for Ayn Rand's books. Just three lines. Great book. Loved it. buy it. Yeah. That sort of thing. It doesn't cost you a thing. And ask yourself if you've done that, you know, because I think it's important, you know. Yep. 150,000 five-star reviews, that's something. So, and to me, it's all about books, you know. And are there more? And I'm trying to get people engaged with, you know, baby steps, you know. Yeah. Do you have anything that comes to mind? And, you know,
I mean, again, I think sometimes people are not ready to read a book. Yeah. So I said there are articles by Ayn Rand on the site. Share, right? Some people these days, they just watch videos. So the end result is not that you want them to watch a video, but maybe if they watch a few videos and they really get excited, they'll go read a book. So share. I mean, that's my biggest recommendation. There's a lot of content. One of the sad things, I think, is that there's a lot of content that Ayn Rand has written, that objectivists have written, that sits in places. And there's so much of it that people, it's ignored. It's not unused. And yet, they're gems. And this is why, for example, this little book on free speech that Steve Simpson just edited and brought out is so great, because there's all this stuff that's been written on free speech that's kind of buried. Nobody's looked at it in years. Suddenly, it bubbles up to the top. Now, but it's all there. And again, just click away. I mean, this is the beauty of technology. You could never do this in the past. So here's a new book that's out. Let your friends know, you know, rank it on Facebook, write little reviews on Ayn Rand's books, on other books, on things you like. But this idea of sharing information and making it so simple that Facebook and Twitter and all these other social media have created is so powerful. It is so powerful. I mean, I get stuff all the time, and I look at stuff and read stuff that I never would have read otherwise, because somebody I like has let me know that this is valuable to look, and I, you know, I'll skim it. And you can get information out there. You know, it really is. Again, if we're going to win, and I think we will, but if we're going to win, we're going to have to be really good at using technology, and you're all going to have to help us be really good at using technology. Because technology leavens the playing field in a sense, because they outnumber us. They have more money than us. They have everything. Where they control the universities. They control the schools. We can still use the internet freely. And for free, almost, right? So help us, you know, just, and it's exactly the kind of stuff you're saying. Reviews, you know, posts, clicks, shares, tweets, quotes, videos, YouTube, you know, lots of YouTubes. So
we have no excuse.
We have really no excuse. I mean, again, think of the leverage you get from everybody in this room sharing one thing to all of your friends. Think of how that multiplies so quickly from a small group to a massive group. Now, that means you're out there with your ideas, but that's what war is like. Yeah, we didn't ask for this war.
Andrew Lehman just reminded me that people on Quora can and should upvote people's...
Yeah, you can also go on, and if you like an answer, you can vote to get it up so that it goes right. So it goes to the top, so that the nasty answer about Ayn Rand doesn't sit there, but that the good answer on Ayn Rand goes to the top.
Right. What I wanted to say, the young lady who was asking about getting our ideas into the schools was obviously too young to have a child in high school, but if you have a child in high school, you can go to the PTA meetings and suggest that there's an essay contest. In fact, there's two of them for children in high school.
Yep.
You know the ones I mean, the ones for Anthem and the Fountainhead.
And you can be on the school board, right? I mean, there's another activism area. You can go on the school board, which determines school curriculum often, school books. I mean, that's a form of activism that I think is incredibly valuable, where you can influence existing schools. Yeah, we'd like to sell them. We'd like to privatize all schools, but we're not going to get there anytime soon. So in the meantime, let's try to influence the schools that we have.
Thank you for the very motivational speech, Yaron. It was definitely...
They told me to be rah-rah, so I tried.
Your round of applause was definitely well-deserved.
Thank you.
So one of the vehicles that leftists have been very successful in transmitting ideas to millennials in particular are, you know, late shows, Daily Show, the one on HBO with that hack. All of these are incredibly influential because, for one, I think that because comedy, people come for the comedy, and because millennials don't have any, or young people don't have any very well-formed ideas until a little bit later, they just imbibe the ideas passively, and that becomes their implicit ideas, and then they become, you know, Bernie Sanders supporters necessarily. Is it necessary for people with the proper ideas, not just objectivists, yeah, but people with the right ideas generally, to enter these kind of fields such as comedy, yeah, as a vehicle for transmitting the right ideas?
Yeah, so look, you can't enter a field you're not excited about, you're not good at, right? I could go do stand-up, but
I certainly don't mean
not going to help. No. Thank you. I mean, for the vote of confidence. No, I'm kidding. But the guy who was making fun of me here last night, right, he should go into comedy. He was, I heard he was pretty good. And if anybody wants to hear the real story about the bear, I'd be happy to tell you. So just come up and ask me later. But again, ultimately, yes, there should be objectivist comedians. It would be great. And they're objectivist late-night talk show hosts. Of course, given the politics of television, it would be very hard if you had those political ideas or philosophical ideas to get that position. But yeah, comedy is a great tool to get ideas out there. Now, it's not a fundamental tool. It's not the most important tool. And I think one of the reasons why comedy is so important in the culture today is because we live in a nihilistic culture. Comedy is about knocking stuff down. And that's fine, because some stuff deserves to be knocked down, and you make fun of it, right? Like me yesterday. But where is he? There he is. Okay, cool. I didn't hear the jokes. You're going to have to do a retelling. So, yeah, we definitely need... I think, again, one of the reasons it's so influential today is because we live in a nihilistic culture in which knocking down is just good to knock down. And there's a certain sense in which comedy today is way too nihilistic, at least for my taste. And I think generally the arts today are very nihilistic, very break things down rather than build and celebrate success. But yeah, we're going to have comedians. We have at least one, right? We're going to have comedians. We're going to have musicians. We're going to have artists in every field. I mean, you could also say, look, there's no objectivist Joan Baez. Now, most of you don't know who Joan Baez is, but Joan Baez was this folk singer in the 60s, very leftist, anti-Vietnam. Great singer, though. Good, you know, she very effective. Bob Dylan, less political. But we don't have that, right? So ultimately, all those things are going to happen. We need to grow. But you can't say, okay, you guys, you become the comedians. You guys, I expect a composition tomorrow and a guitar thing, and you guys are going to be paint. I mean, it doesn't work that way. It's going to have to come from you, from what your interests are and what your talents are and what you're willing to invest time in. Comedy is really hard, really hard, and it requires incredible sense of timing, and it requires really skills, and it's skills like everything else. You have to hone them. You have to practice them. You know, there's this thing about 10,000 hours. If you do something 10,000, to be good, you have to do something for 10,000 hours. I have a feeling that it's not that anything you do for 10,000 hours you're good at. I think it's if you have to do 10,000 hours, it's a necessary but not sufficient condition to do the 10,000 hours. But yeah, if somebody wants to do, practice it, and get great at it, go for it. That'd be great. Yeah.
Just another thing with regard to technology, yeah, and I think there's a really unique opportunity now. We can reach, in terms of sharing things, we can reach people who have a lot more influence. Like you see people with all kinds of Twitter followers. I think Adam Carolla mentioned, you know, equal is unfair because someone just shared something.
Yeah, so that's a great point, which I was going to make in the lecture, but I forgot. So thanks for mentioning it. So let me say this. Look, this is another thing you can really help. So Adam Carolla, who's one of the biggest bloggers in the world, I guess, and has more downloads or has won... You know, he's one of the biggest bloggers. Millions of people listen to Adam Carolla. he was talking about inequality and luck, I think, and people tweeted equal is unfair, you should read this. So they actually went and they got a copy of the book and they looked up a section on luck and they read it on air. Millions of people listen to this, or a couple of million downloads, I think they get. And then people started tweeting, oh, you should get Don and Yuan on your show, you should get Don and Yuan on your show. So they said, oh, well, I guess we should. So I'll probably be on the show in a couple of weeks, right? The best interview I've ever done that's gotten the best response I've ever had was on Dave Rubin, on the Rubin Report, which I did, I don't know now, 6 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago, something like that. And it was an hour-long interview, and he was great. And I didn't know who he was. And the only reason he invited me is because people were tweeting. Some of you had discovered Dave Rubin way before I did, and you watched him, and he'd interviewed Sam Harris and done a bunch of really interesting interviews. And you said, hey, Dave Rubin, you should interview Yaron Brook. And the tweets went out, and his producers saw it, and always looking for guests, and they probably looked me up, and they said, hey, yeah, we should interview Yaron Brook. And it's fabulous. It's the most watched video I have ever done. In just in 8 weeks, it's been watched by over 60,000 people, right? And I got a thousand followers on Twitter just from that one interview. So whoever among you tweeted to Dave Rubin to have me on the show, you're responsible for the fact that 1,000 people are now more and are following me, that 60,000 people have watched this interview, and who knows what is have done beyond that. I got a lot of little notes like, I never thought of reading Ayn Rand before because of everything I had heard about her, but now I'm really intrigued. I'm going to pick up her book. So whoever did that tweet, simple tweet, really easy, took 2 seconds. Hey, Dave Rubin, you should have Yaron Brook on the show. You're responsible for thousands of people reading Ayn Rand now. So great work. That's exactly the kind of thing that really helps what we do. And if we did a lot more of that, you know, who knows? The sky's the limit.
Can I say one quick thing with that? Even like Twitter, but they might not pay attention if you don't have a lot of followers, but a lot of times you can just even find the email addresses of these people and just try.
Yeah, there are lots of ways to contact people. Facebook, Twitter, email. They're always looking for guests. Your recommendation, because their listeners matter to them. Yeah, great point. Thanks for the question. This will be the last one. Are you going to make it short?
I'll do my best.
Great.
The Dave Rubin thing is actually a great point. So I watched that. It's a very calm, relaxed interview. He gives you time to talk. Yeah. In your experience, is it a good idea to open up with some of the more shocking consequences of objectivism, like advocating for the right of children to work or advocating for the objectivist view of how war should be conducted? Is that a way to implant doubt in people's heads that is effective?
I mean, that's not a simple question to answer. Yes and no. It depends on the audience. It depends where you're doing it. Sometimes you have to do it, right? When Bill O'Reilly says, like he did, you know, so what are you going to do with, Fallujah or whatever? You can't say, well, let me set the context now, because he's going to give you exactly 25 seconds to talk, and you got to tell the truth. And the truth is pretty shocking in terms of what needs to be done, and I did, and I've never been on Bill O'Reilly's show again. So sometimes shock works. But you have to, you know, this is why, you know, I think we're professionals. We calibrate when to do it and when not to do it, right? And how to do it. And I wouldn't start a conversation with somebody when you have time and when you engage with something by shock therapy. It's not good. You got to build a context. You got to build a rapport. You got to build up to it. So Dave Rubin gave me this platform to have a relaxed, lengthy, nice conversation. That was great. I could talk about epistemology and ethics and then a few applications. And I'll be back again to talk about other things. And then one day, we'll get to child labor and how to win the war, right? There's no necessity to start. And I wouldn't have got the thousands of followers if I'd said some of the. As it is, people were horrified by the idea that a safety net should be voluntary in terms of charity and not by the state. They thought, but that's okay. You know, so a little bit, you're pushing, right? But you don't have to shock them so that they turn it off and walk away. To the extent that you have the time and you have the relationship, build it up. Build it up. And again, our strength, and I'll end with this, our strength is the positive, not the negative. This is why I hate, I'm sorry, Elon, but I don't like talking about foreign policy because it's almost all about bad, you know, things that you have to do to other people that is not pleasant. We're about happiness, success, prosperity, values, virtues, living a great life. That's where the focus needs to be. The political issues, the controversial issues, the shock issues, those will come. You'll get to those. But if you can get people to live, to embrace the idea of living for themselves, then everything else will take care of itself over time. Irrationally living for themselves. Reason is important. Reason and egoism. If we can get those two, everything else takes care of itself. Thank you all.
All material in this program is protected by copyright and may not be reproduced in any form or manner, nor played before a live audience without the express written permission of the producer, the Ayn Rand Institute. For further information or to order other products, please visit estore.aynrand.org or call 1-800-729-6149. For free online courses on Ayn Rand's ideas, go to campus.aynrand.org.